I'm Alex Craner. I'm a band author and a former hedge fund manager based in Monaco of Croatian origin. And I write on iSystemTrendFollowing.com. I write at The Naked Hedgie, and my Twitter handle is at Naked Hedgie.
Now, I know
So.
you've penned some stuff recently on the beginning of the Second World War, because there was a whole period of appeasement between Chamberlain's government and Hitler, wasn't there?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, that's I was prompted by the recent escalation between Russia and the West, and some of the people in the West started invoking appeasement to try to draw parallels between what is happening today and what was happening in 1938. And I know that the history of appeasement in 1938 was not at all, it did not happen at all the way they taught us in school. And the danger in drawing those parallels is because the insinuation. So this was Victoria Nuland, former Assistant Secretary of State under Obama administration, and Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger made those remarks. The insinuation is that today Ukraine is Czechoslovakia, that Donbas is the Sudetenland, and that Vladimir Putin is Adolf Hitler. And so if those parallels were valid, then that would suggest that appeasing the new Hitler, Vladimir Putin, could lead to another tragedy of World War on European continent. But of course, these parallels are completely self-serving. They're absolutely not valid. And the danger is that it kind of moves people to think that, oh my God, if the situation is that grave, then that justifies just any effort to stop the new Hitler from gaining ground, even if it means confronting him militarily. And so that kind of prompted me to revisit that historical episode and present it the way it apparently did happen, rather than the way they taught us it happened. The way we learned about this in school was that Neville Chamberlain had good intentions, that his intentions were to prevent a wider war from breaking out on the European continent, and that to avoid that war, he was prepared to sacrifice Czechoslovakia and greenlight Hitler to take over Czechoslovakia. Whereas in reality, Neville Chamberlain and his foreign policy cabal were very actively involved in the negotiations between Nazi Germany and Czechoslovakia, at least since March 1938, meaning 6 months before the crisis came to a head. And so their role in this mess was that they were consistently bolstering Hitler's demand from Czechoslovakia. Hitler wanted to take over Sudetenland, which was the region to the northwest of the country, bordering with Germany, which had the majority German population and which was the most economically most advanced and most industrialized region of Czechoslovakia. And so Neville Chamberlain and his foreign policy cabinet, they consistently bolstered Hitler's demand from Czechoslovakia, and they consistently encouraged Czechoslovakia to yield to Hitler. And every time Czechoslovakia would accept Hitler's demand, then they would encourage Hitler to up the ante and to make new demands until the demands became impossible to accept. And so that's kind of the way this went, rather than, so, you know, to conclude the story, rather than Neville Chamberlain having good intentions but poor judgment, they orchestrated the crisis and managed it and led it to the exact outcome that they intended. And now somebody might say, well, why on earth would they intend that? What would they be possibly gaining by letting Hitler take over Czechoslovakia? And basically, the reason is because the British Empire still had the ambition to rule the world through three blocks. So that was the three-block global agenda. It was articulated explicitly by them. It wasn't a secret. Lord Halifax explicitly articulated this agenda in the aftermath of the appeasement and the Munich agreement in September 1938, and he basically laid it out as a way of setting up a new world order in three blocks, where Euro-Atlantic bloc would be dominated by the alliance between the UK and the United States. Continental Europe would be dominated by Germany as the hegemon who controlled particularly Central and Eastern Europe. And the Far Eastern dominions would be controlled in alliance with Japan. And basically, that all was part of the larger agenda, which was already formulated in 1904 by Halford Mackinder in his Heartland theory, which basically entailed that ruling Eastern Europe was the key to dominating the Eurasian landmass. And the domination of Eurasian landmass has been and still is the empire's overarching imperative, because that's where most of the world's GDP, population, and resources are.
Isn't this what they call the world island?
Yeah, exactly. So Halford Mackinder called this the world island, correct. And so basically, if you want your corporations to exploit these resources and labor power, and your banks to finance the development of these resources, then you have to dominate it. And so Germany was being set up as the hegemon on the European continent facing the east, and also as a military bludgeon with which to eliminate the perennial rival, which is Russia. And so essentially, we have the same thing today in a different packaging. So it's not being done by the brute military force, but it's being done through quote unquote democratic institutions of the United of the European Union. But even in this arrangement, Germany is being set up as the hegemon among the supposed equals. So basically, that's the larger agenda, of which appeasement was just an episode. And appeasement basically was the policy of letting Hitler take over Czechoslovakia, which was at the time the strongest military power in the region, stronger than Germany. It was by far the best administered country that came out of the former Habsburg Empire. It was very wealthy and it was very well industrialized. It had a very, very powerful military, lots of tanks, airplanes, armored vehicle, machine guns, cannons, all of that stuff. And so Neville Chamberlain's actions allowed Hitler to take all this without a shot being fired, practically. And that eliminated the one power in Central Europe that could check Hitler's expansionism. And so that was the true story of appeasement rather than the airbrushed and sanitized version that we learned in school.
Yeah, and also something, you know, I don't think is really well known in Britain was the role of Montague Norman, who was the governor of the Bank of England at the time. He basically made sure that the money from the captured and the assets from the captured Czech bank made its way straight to Berlin with no problem. And that at the time, there were a few eyebrows raised about that. But there seemed to have been some collaboration with all of this, from amongst elements in the British establishment. And the other person who's well known to have been pro-Hitler at the time, of course, was the previous king who'd abdicated. He was Edward VIII. And so there was quite an element within the British establishment that seemed to be absolutely behind Hitler, really without any doubt, to try and create a bulwark against the Soviet Union that they were about to enter into World War II as allies with.
That is correct. The problem was that Hitler had his own opinions about where he wanted to take the German mission. And so they were not able to control. But you're absolutely right. Montagu Norman played the pivotal role in all this. Hitler was very, very abundantly funded by the Wall Street banks. Also, he had very large credit from London banks, something at the time amounting to about a billion British pounds. And you're right that once Hitler took over Czechoslovakia, Hitler took over Czechoslovakia in two phases. First was in September 1938, when he only took over the Sudeten region. But then by March 1939, he just took over the whole rest of Czechoslovakia, that is the today's Czech Republic, not Slovakia, the Bohemia-Moravia region. They turned it into a protectorate under Berlin's rule, but that was a breach of the Munich Agreement from 1938. Regardless of that, Montagu Norman transferred 6 million pounds of Czech gold that was held by the Bank of England for on behalf of Czechoslovakia. He simply transferred those assets to Hitler's Nazi Germany. And then he was also very close friend and collaborator with German economy minister and central banker Hjalmar Schacht. Hjalmar Schacht was practically his his partner in managing the flow of money between Germany and the West and, you know, Britain and the United States. So yeah, definitely the banking the London and Wall Street banking establishments practically created Hitler. Apparently, already in the 1920s, they recruited Hitler as a young man at the time in Vienna, and they kind of cultivated him to become Germany's leader, and they deliberately cultivated like a slightly unhinged nationalist, because the bankers had a problem with German obligations towards France, right? So after the Versailles Treaty, after World War One, Germany owed very large sums in war reparations to France. And so France had very significant claims on German wealth, German money production, and so forth. And the Wall Street bankers and London bankers wanted somebody who would be brazen and bold to break this, to just tell the French, you know, you're not getting a penny from us, so that they could, you know, invest in Germany without having to have liabilities towards France. So apparently for that reason, they wanted a slightly unhinged, fanatical, nationalistic guy, and Hitler fit the bill. And they funded his rise to power, they funded the Nazi Party, they provided very abundant capital for economic development, the bulk of which went towards military technology productions. There was also very significant technology transfers between the United States and Germany, where, you know, a lot of these technologies that were necessary to produce advanced weaponry were simply transferred from the United States to Germany, and the Wall Street bankers funded these transfers and these licenses that were provided, you know, through whatever IG Farben, Ford, and many other of these large corporations that in some form still many of which still exist today in one form or another. But yeah, basically the intertwining interests between West and the Nazi Germany and Hitler are quite far reaching. And fortunately, you know, with the internet now, a lot of this truth that had been obscured deliberately is coming out. So, you know, if you want to pay attention, if you want to do a little bit of research and reading, it's not difficult to find out. So I think it's very fascinating. But today, given where we are between in the relations between Russia and the West, you know, and the new Hitler, Vladimir Putin, I think it's kind of incumbent on us to reach some clarity about these lessons of history, so that we don't sleepwalk into another world war, because at this point that would be unthinkable. So there, yeah, that whole picture. Coupled also with my personal experience, you know, I was raised in the former Yugoslavia, and I was 21 when war in the Balkans broke out. It was a completely unthinkable thing, and I promise you that 2 days before the war broke out, nobody believed that such an outcome was even possible. Nobody thought there would be a war. But then once it did break out, you know, it almost takes a life of its own. You can't reverse it from that point on. So I think we should be vigilant. I think we should not be complacent. And I think we should understand that the war dynamic is coming from the West, not from Russia. And that is something also that we don't commonly know, but there was a very important paper published in a journal, I forget which now, in 2014. I think Journal of Public Health, something like this. But the researchers looked back from between 1946 and 2001, and they tallied up some 253 or so wars that had broken out around the world, and they found that the United States had initiated fully 80% of those wars. So, you know, there's some kind of a dynamic, there's some kind of an, you know, incentive system in the whole plumbing of the society that makes it very trigger happy, that it makes it very inclined to go to war. So there should not be this idea of equivalence. Yeah, you know, like the US and NATO, they're aggressive, they're bad, but you know, Russia and China, they're exactly the same. They're not necessarily exactly the same, you know, like we have been taken over by the military industrial complexes in the West, and we have lost institutional breaks on war waging. So I think, you know, to wrap it up, we need to be vigilant about these things. We need to try to use the legitimate democratic structures to the extent that they still function to put pressure on policymakers and to tell them that we do not war. We do not want war. You know, it was like a month ago, more or less, when Boris Johnson put it in terms of, hey, what do we want? Do we want like large pipelines flowing large amounts of Russian hydrocarbons into Europe, or do we want to stick up for freedom and democracy in Ukraine? You know, basically, he made that choice. This is our choice. You know, do we want trade and cooperation with Russia, or do we want to go to war with them? I think we should, from ordinary people's and most businesses' point of view, trade and cooperation is always better. But we need to make sure that our policymakers don't run amok, because there are narrow structures of society that positively want this war. And I think that rather than complacently waiting to see what happened, we need to like try to exert pressure on our policymakers to make sure that they know that we are watching them and that we do not want this war.
Do you think the rewriting of history works? Because it seems to me that, you know, what you were saying about these enormous amount of pressure from the United States to create wars, which I think most people would agree the US is the big aggressor on the planet, that they have decided that they're going to simply carry on with this, and yet they'll cover it with propaganda, with the idea that the media will be behind everything they do and provide cover for them. Do you think that'll work?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure, Tony. I think that things have changed today. Rewriting history used to work. I don't think it works today anymore, because the information is coming out in great abundance. You know, like, I do my research, I read, I write, but there are tens of thousands of people who are doing this, you know, and we're kind of always being drawn onto, you know, subjects and topics that actually matter. So we're, you know, like, people are uncovering relevant truths every day. And I think that the old methods of censorship, where you identify, you know, the handful who maybe you need to silence, I don't think it works today anymore, because there are too many. There are too many, and you know, it's kind of like King Canute flogging the waves to turn the tides. It just doesn't work. So we've never had the internet before. You know, before, information used to be broadcast from central points that you control. You know, newspapers, radio, and television. Today you have social networks that, even though they try very hard to censor the flow of information, they can't. I mean, I'm on Facebook, and I'm perfectly aware of heavy-handed censorship being done by Facebook. But by the time they know what they need to censor, what they need to silence, you know, like, hundreds of thousands of people, maybe millions of people have seen the information. And they go like, oh my God, look at this. What's that? That's interesting. Let's look into this. And so I think that this even translates into, you know, I think that West has largely lost its appetite for war. And I think we've seen this very recently, you know, already in Ukraine, the NATO and the United States have pretty much shown their cards that they're not interested to go to war against Russia in Ukraine. They're not going to send troops and join Ukraine in fighting Russia. So they pretty much made it clear. Last August, they withdrew finally from Afghanistan. They lost a hold of Syria, and Iraq is slipping away as well. I think that the whole war waging model of, you know, knocking down regimes and governments and countries has become a bit of a wet noodle from the West. So I think that part of the reason why is because the public in the West has also, you know, not everybody, obviously, but a good segment of the public has wisened up to what's going on, and they're not interested, and they're not willing to send their sons and daughters to bleed to death for somebody's delusional imperial projects. So I think that has sapped the West unity and resolve to you know, wage war on other nations and get their way by force. So I don't think the censorship works anymore. I think that rewriting history is getting undone as well, because, you know, what we're just talking about now is part of that, you know, because we're going beyond the truth that they told us in school, and that we should be content that we think we know what happened. But, you know, clearly people are curious and they're questioning what they've been told.
Yeah, well, certainly some people are curious, but I think, you know, for the majority, they haven't got the time to go and chase all this stuff down, Alex. But look, we spoke to you, well, must be 6 months ago or so, about your theories about COVID, the plandemic, and Theranos, the links, possible links between Elizabeth Holmes' failed company. And she has just been found guilty of fraud, and I think other counts too, for her massive scam, basically, in bringing in enormous amounts of money from very powerful, wealthy people, including Rupert Murdoch, Henry Kissinger, etc., and basically conning them. It's difficult to know whether some of these people were in on it, but they certainly made an absolute fortune for a while. On a product which was supposed to do multiple tests on drops of blood in order to find out everything about what might be wrong with you, and diagnose things and prescribe, you know, some sort of cure for you. Sounded almost too good to be true. And of course, it was, because it didn't work. But it's like the most incredible Silicon Valley con trick ever pulled. And I noticed, just amazingly, that there's another startup. In fact, there may be others too, that you know of. One called Grail, which is just much more recently doing something similar. A Silicon Valley startup created the Galleri test, which can screen for more than 50 different types of cancers just by taking one drop of blood and looking at the DNA shed by cancer tumours. So there are these sorts of technology. Seems to be that even though Elizabeth Holmes is going to jail, probably, because we haven't actually had the sentencing yet, but even though that Theranos has been a flop, a failure, a con, that this kind of technology is going to be, you know, with us in the not too distant future, maybe here to stay.
You're right that there are other companies that they're developing for this various rapid testing, blood testing, to diagnose various illnesses. But I'd like to just explain where this ties in with where we are today. So basically, you know, I was sitting at a hedge fund office when Theranos became the rising star. You know, Elizabeth Holmes was the first self-made female billionaire, or the youngest one. I forget exactly, but there was a time, I think in 2014, when she was on the cover of every important magazine. She was nonstop on television, on all these, in all these conferences and panels and so forth. And the media couldn't get enough of her. And so she was this great genius who invented a miniature device for blood testing. And so, working as a hedge fund manager, the first aware is skepticism, you know. So I was kind of, well, you know, this kind of seems too good to be true. Let's look into it. And then, you know, like when I saw her board of directors, then I instantly knew that this was not what it's being sold as, what is being, you know, promoted as. So her board of directors, she had George Shultz, she had Henry Kissinger, she had Admiral, geez, I forgot the name, Whitehead, I think. She had Mad Dog Mattis, General James Mattis, the future defense secretary. She had Senator Sam Nunn. The whole team were deep state actors with, you know, various foreign policy roles. Basically what I would say, the empire builders.
Okay, so look, let me stop you for a second, because what you're saying is that these people were were in on it, basically, rather than that they had been duped by her and thought, well, this is a great prestige project that I'd love to be involved with, that they would have known that, that there was something going on here.
No, they were absolutely in on the, on it. There was no doubt about it. Even, and apparently the people who were most deeply involved with the project were George Shultz and also one of the very important venture capitalists, Don Lucas Sr. It's not a household name, but he was the one of the most prominent venture capitalists in Silicon Valley. And basically Don Lucas Sr. had weekly lunch meetings with Elizabeth Holmes, and he basically coached her about what she was doing. And another person who was very closely involved in those lunches with Don Lucas Sr. and Elizabeth Holmes was Larry Ellison, the CEO and founder of Oracle. They all have very interesting deep state connections. So the idea that she managed to dupe all these people into joining the board of directors, into collectively sinking $750 million into this project is absolute nonsense. They were in on it. The thing was fake, phony, and verifiably didn't work from the very get-go. And they had, it was very easy for them to know this and to find out. Basically, she was funded by Don Lucas Sr. And she was also funded by another large, the name escapes me at the moment, another very, very important venture capitalist in the Silicon Valley. Normally, these venture capital groups specialize in a limited number of industry, right? You might be specializing in e-commerce technologies. You might be specializing in healthcare technologies or pharmaceuticals or whatever. Normally, you would retain staff in your company or outsource them, but you would have recourse to very highly qualified staff that could perform due diligence on these projects, because you have a lot of these startups in the Silicon Valley who are falling over themselves to get money from these venture capital companies. And so they have to go and present their technology, explain how they intend to build the company, show some proof of concept. And you have these people doing due diligence who are there to pick them apart. Well, Elizabeth Holmes' thing was very easy to pick apart because her technology simply didn't work. And not only did it not work, it couldn't theoretically work. Okay, because what was very well known to anybody who was involved in diagnostics and blood testing is that you cannot even theoretically run 200 diagnostics tests out of a small box, which was basically the size of a desktop computer. That it was just simply inconceivable. It could not be done, even theoretically. And so she was going out with a fraudulent story that should have been very easy to spot from 10 miles away. But nevertheless, she managed to get all this money on board, a total of $750 million, including from people like Betsy DeVos family, from Rupert Murdoch, from Larry Ellison, from Carlos Slim, and so forth. And these people never did any due diligence. Like, that's really, really strange. And then she assembles this high power board of directors of consisting of individuals who not a single one of them had any healthcare expertise. None of them were doctors. None of them knew anything about biochemistry, about blood testing, about diagnostics. They were all foreign policy deep state actors.
And yeah, so. Hang on, because maybe that was the point, that she wanted prestige people there that wouldn't, you know, know the right questions to ask.
Yeah, but how would you get a George Shultz or a Henry Kissinger on board if you couldn't even pass like a freshman student's due diligence about the technology and the product that you're running. Her technology simply didn't function. It should have been easy to set, easy to establish. You know, like they brought her to the Stanford professor of medicine. Let me look up her name. It escapes me now. Dr. Phyllis Gardner, right? She was a professor of medicine in Stanford, and they introduced Elizabeth Holmes to Dr. Phyllis Gardner, and it took her one conversation to see that this young woman was full of it, that she didn't have any idea what she was doing, right? And so somebody like Henry Kissinger or George Shultz should have been able to ring up like a true expert and to say, I'm being offered a sit on the board of directors of this promising new startup. Can you please look into it? I don't want to sully my name. And the answer should have been dead easy. Like, don't do this. It's a fraud. But that's not what happened. And then, you know, we can take it further. So one of the employees at Theranos was George Shultz's grandson, Tyler Shultz. And so Tyler Shultz in the whole story appears like a young man with like a very bright young man with his humanity and his integrity fully intact. And so he got friendly with an employee called Erica Chung, which was one of the lab workers. And she had very significant concerns because she saw that this technology absolutely did not work and that they were misrepresenting the technology both to the investors and to the clients and to the patients who they were already testing with. And so she spoke with Tyler Shultz and she told him all this, and Tyler Shultz decided to organize a dinner at his grandfather's house. And so Erica Chung and Tyler Shultz went to see George Shultz for dinner one evening, and they firsthand explained to George Shultz what had happened and what's going on at the company. And there was like all kinds of problems there, but principally that the company that he is sitting on the board of directors was a fraud, that the technology didn't work, that they were lying to clients, that they were lying to their partners, to the investors and to the patients, and that the blood testing technology was terribly inaccurate even for the test that they were doing. And George Shultz's reaction was not to investigate, and then when the suspicions were confirmed, to immediately distance himself, to resign from the board of directors. His reaction was the opposite. He hired a law firm to go against any potential whistleblowers. This was a David Boies company. David Boies was one of the most prominent lawyers on the Democratic Party side, and they went aggressively against whistleblowers. Erica Chung was fired, and George Shultz encouraged his grandson to also resign from the company and to leave. He stayed with the company to the bitter end. Okay. And this deception lasted not, you know, like for a couple of months. This went on for 12 years. You know, that like one young woman can fool all these people for 12 years, doesn't hold any water. This is completely ridiculous. And you know, the more you look into the story, the more you see that she was merely fronting the project. The project was something else altogether, and I'll explain what it was. I believe that the project, and there you know, like there are good reasons to believe. I put together a video on my YouTube channel about this. The project was intended as an information weapon, because this was supposed to be a place where you could get your blood test every week. It was supposed to be within 5 miles of every American household. You would be able to go there and for just like cents or just a few bucks, get your blood tested. And then they would tell you that you have this disease or that disease, and that you should have that treatment or another treatment, or that you should be stay locked down in your house. So this was being prepared as part of the pandemic agenda. And I think that the reason why today's pandemic agenda is largely based on PCR testing is because Theranos failed. Okay. I think it was meant to be a, because, okay, the idea, the architecture of the system was that you had these little testing units everywhere, in every pharmacy, in every Walgreens, where you could get blood tests, and then they could, the data from these testers was collected and analyzed at central servers in the Silicon Valley, right? So then these central servers in the Silicon Valley would produce the results and send them back to wherever the test had been performed. And then they could, you know, conjure up pandemics and outbreaks where they like. They could say, like, okay, this week let's have an outbreak in Portugal. Let's have an outbreak in Istanbul, you know. And if everybody was in some way obliged or encouraged to regularly do these tests, then they could just run any kind of pandemic scenario by simply telling you, okay, now you have this, now you have that, now you should stay locked down, now you should be wearing a mask, now you should be taking this vaccine. And this, I think, is the only explanation that can help us understand how all these very, very powerful, very, very important people invested in this company, served as directors, didn't distance themselves when the fraud was exposed, and continued to support Elizabeth Holmes even when it was plain and clear that she was a fraud.
But it does seem as if there are other firms doing similar things, not exactly the same. And also, of course, we've got the diagnostics that's going on still in the wake of COVID. I've seen, for example, we had a most extraordinary thing this week in China, where a city of 1.2 million people is put onto a full lockdown, it looks like for several weeks, where people aren't even allowed to leave their homes because of three asymptomatic positive tests.
Yeah, I don't understand that. I don't understand it, but I do know that there were, you know, Silicon Valley investors continued to back a number of these ventures. It's not, you know, you had last summer, or when was it, that Bill Gates and the Soros Economic Development Fund purchased the UK-based COVID testing company MoLogic, which allegedly developed a 10-minute test for COVID. And then you had other companies that had been developing the same purpose technology as Theranos. One of them is called Truvian, which is still around. One of them is called Athelas, and one of them is called Genolite, and Genolite is the closest match to what Theranos was intended to be. And Genolite's founder Kerry Gunn has even been explicit about embracing Elizabeth Holmes' vision and trying to develop a product that actually works, but for the exact same purpose and for the, you know, in the same way as Theranos was intended to be. They just hope that they will be able to execute a bit better than Elizabeth Holmes was. So yeah, you know, the search for this technology that would be able to convince us that we have this or that disease, that could encourage us to take this or that therapy or vaccine or whatever, they are still investing heavily into developing this kind of technology. And I even read very recently that Joe Biden just invested some 130 or so million dollars into a German company that would do fast COVID tests. And the crazy thing about this investment is that it wouldn't even, the company wouldn't even begin distributing these tests until like maybe another 2 years. So they're making heavy investments into things that will produce results in 2 years' time for COVID testing. So they obviously have no intention of dismounting this whole agenda. They have a apparently full intention of taking it forward as far as it'll go.
So what's the point?
Well, what's the point is to contrive emergencies that allow them to govern and ride roughshod over laws, over democratic institutions, over civil liberties, over censorship, anything they want. Because you know, if they declare an emergency, and they can convince the public that there really is an emergency, they can convince you to accept being in under house arrest. They can get you to accept to vaccinate your children and keep them wearing face masks for 2 freaking years, and comply with all that nonsense. And they can then also coerce you to accept living your life on conditional freedom with vaccine passes that expire at some point and that you have to get renewed all the time, and that could ultimately be linked to your bank account and to your internet and to your utilities, and that they can, you know, like easily disconnect you from everything if you don't comply with whatever they decide that you need to comply with.
But who are they? Because they clearly don't include Elizabeth Holmes anymore.
Oh, no, she was just the front person. She was an ambitious young woman whom they selected because it was obvious that she was ready to advance towards her ambition over people's dead bodies. She didn't mind. She didn't mind lying. She didn't mind stealing. She didn't mind defrauding investors, customers, patients. She had absolutely no scruples and no moral compass. That was her role. The people who were driving the show was principally George Shultz, and then other people. You know, it seems that the nursery of this ideology was the Brookings Institution. Most of the people who were involved with Theranos were had links to the Brookings Institution. And so, who are they? They are, again, still, even if we talk about people like George Shultz and Henry Kissinger, they are still kind of generals. They're not the people at the top of the pyramid. The people at the top of the pyramid always are the global banking cartel. They are the ones running the show. They are the ones behind this pandemic agenda. There's no doubt about that. And we know that from what has actually happened through this pandemic.
So how has the pandemic served the agenda of bankers then?
Well, basically their financials, you know, their control over the society, the mechanism of control is their financial system. The way capital is allocated, to whom, how, where, and the way we have to use money they conjure out of thin air. Every last dollar, pound, yen, euro that's in circulation came into circulation as debt. So it wouldn't be in circulation if somebody didn't take it out as debt, right? Somebody took out a loan for that money to be in circulation, and it has to be paid back with interest. And the amounts that constitute interest never go into circulation. So the only way for there to be enough money to pay loans back with interest is for other people to go into debt and increase the money mass, right? So basically what you have is literally a Ponzi scheme. And the Ponzi scheme eventually, you know, it's only stable so far as it can grow. Once it can no longer grow, and that happens if you run out of healthy collateral, Once it can no longer grow, it starts to implode. And we saw it start to implode in September 2019 because we had that very severe repo crisis. The repo crisis is basically, how to explain it, repos are repurchase agreements. So banks have to have, when they close their book at the end of each day, they have to have sufficient reserves with the Federal Reserve Bank in New York to square their books. And if they don't have sufficient reserves, they have to borrow it from another bank. So this is how the repo market came into being. Basically, banks borrow money from each other, usually overnight or for very short periods of time, so that they could cover their reserve requirements with the Federal Reserve Bank. Okay. And so this is easy money for the banks because they lend money to each other just overnight or just for a few days or a week, whatever. And basically, the repurchase part means that you sell a debt obligation to another bank and then you repurchase it at maturity at a higher price. So let's say I lend you $1 billion and you agree to pay me back $1 billion and $1 million. So for me, it's an easy $1 million at this point. Okay. Why would I not earn this $1 million if I have the billion to loan you, right? What happened in September of 2019 is that this repo market suddenly crashed and interest rates on these repo loans exploded to something like 9 or 10%. So that is a sure indication that one of the banks, one or more banks in the system are bust because the other banks are no longer willing to lend them money overnight because they're afraid that they won't get paid. So if these large, too big to fail banks, these, you know, as the Bank of International Settlements calls them, the systemically important banks, which is about, I don't know, about 20 banks in the world. If one of them is bust, then there's a good chance that in a chain reaction, a large number of them, maybe most of them, will go bust. So you can't allow this avalanche to go out of control. So the Fed stepped in and started providing a very, very large amount of liquidity for this repo market to continue existing and to backstop these banks so that they don't fail. Okay, but that all means that the financial system is starting to collapse. Okay, and so you need to replace the financial system with something, you know, because it is going to crash. There's no, you know, it's a mathematically an inevitability. There's going to be large defaults, except that, you know, like if you start using the printing press to cover every bad debt, to cover every loss, to backstop every bank failure, then you're going to generate hyperinflation along the way. And your system is going to collapse. For the people running the show who use this financial system as a mechanism of control over society, to not lose control, they need to replace the financial system. And the plan is to go to central bank digital currencies. Right. No more cash, just digital currencies in your, you know, digital bank account. But in order to make sure that people don't resort to alternative currencies, that they don't invent their own, like cryptos, like time banks, like local and regional currencies, to make sure that people remain locked in the system, they need these electronic things that start as COVID passes, right? Electronic IDs where, you know, like your health record is there, your bank account is linked to it, and you have no, you know, like you have no way out of the matrix, because if you step out of the matrix, if you misbehave, if your social credit goes down, they can cut you off. They can block your account.
Yeah,
they
but, can, I mean, surely you can do the same thing on an ordinary credit card or debit card.
Yeah, but if you still have cash in the system, then people can resort to cash. And I think that it's also very important to them to be able to exercise this control to preempt dissent, because, you know, people can also, let's say if we are in a democratic society, people can demand a fairer system. People can demand a system that is not fraudulent, because the current monetary system is based on fraud from the get-go. The whole thing is a fraudulent Ponzi scheme. So, you know, at some point people can demand a fairer monetary system. They can start resorting to gray and black markets, which they will anyway. And so I think that this fantasy of total control has led these, you know, these quote unquote elites to adopt this agenda where, you know, like they would turn humanity basically into cattle. Everybody would be a number. Everybody would have their remuneration in an electronic money held at a single central bank. And the agenda is actually to have one bank for the whole world, one global central bank, and everybody has an account with that global central bank. And of course, you only have access to your money, provided that you behave yourself, that you're not a dissident, that you're not opposing their projects and their goals, and that your social credit is sufficiently high. So you have to be up to date with your vaccines. You have to, you know, I don't know what all things they could think up, but they could, you know, like if they get us into this matrix, if we accept these COVID passes and these permits that are obviously designed so that they expire, we are consenting to conditional liberties that can be taken away at somebody's whim. And that means that we're going to gift our children with a future and that will not be worth living. They will be heads of cattle. They will be a resource like any other. And, you know, that also means that when you are not a productive member of the society, then they can find ways to, you know, maybe accelerate your passing, which they're already, you know, doing in some places, you know.
Well, I mean, you know, I think there's this whole business of assisted dying, which is definitely open to abuse. You know, the idea that someone is elderly and vulnerable, and a single doctor in some cases can just simply say, "Oh, well, they've decided they want to die," and off they go. But look, you've evaded a little bit my question about China, because we've seen, and it's interesting how you're talking about people moving away from using money possibly and doing things like bartering or whatever. But we've got that going on right now, this week in China, as something like 15 million Chinese are locked in their homes under house arrest in Xi'an. The BBC reports yesterday that residents in lockdown are trading goods for food amid the shortage, because the government in China has promised to leave food parcels outside everybody's door every day, but they're simply not doing it.
Tony, the reason why I don't really want to comment on China is because I don't believe that the reports we get from China, particularly if they come from the BBC, should be taken at their face value. So, you know, I would be commenting BBC's report on something that supposedly is happening in China, but I don't trust the BBC. And I know for a fact that many of the stories we get about China are flat out outright fabrications and lies. So I, you know, like I'd rather not comment it, because maybe it'll turn out that it wasn't true at all, that it never happened, because we've had stories that never happened that were served up by Reuters, by BBC, whoever, as a matter of fact. And so I don't know what the Chinese government is doing. I don't know whether what BBC reported is true at all, whether it's distorted, whether it's exaggerated, or whether it never happened, even in any version.
Well, amazing. But I mean, there is evidence that there's film of people being marched by the authorities in China through the streets, who have apparently broken the lockdown rules over there in front of everybody with a policeman on each arm. And you don't have you not seen those? And do you think that's not happening?
I've seen various films from China, but you know, it's I still don't trust them. And you know, you could see films of people being marched by down the streets by the police, who may look Chinese, and but that might be a picture of something completely different. You know, like when I think it was BBC, when they were reporting about big demonstrations against Gaddafi in 2011 or whenever it was, and then it turned out that these were demonstrations where they were in India, people were holding Indian flags, and then we also saw large demonstrations reported in Tehran against Ahmadinejad, but they basically cropped Ahmadinejad out of the picture. It was a rally of support for Ahmadinejad. So I don't believe pictures at all. I don't believe films. I don't believe satellite images, because they can all be taken out of context, misinterpreted, and again, mislead the public. And so,
is there anywhere we can go to get some reasonably trustworthy news on television?
I'm not sure. I would, you know, I could say the Chinese sources, but I wouldn't trust them either. So I don't know. I would trust people who are on the ground in China and who can report on some of these things. But I don't happen to know people like this. You know, I have some contacts in China, but they're Chinese people. I don't ask them. I don't bother them with asking them to comment on political things, because they are clearly not inclined to do that. And I don't know how much they know themselves. You know, like I lived in the former Yugoslavia. I didn't always know what was going on in former Yugoslavia before the breakout of war. So I think it's not easy to know the truth about these things, and I definitely wouldn't buy truth from the BBC.
Okay. Well, look, final question, which is about the Theranos, back to Theranos, really, is we had I think it was John, I'm trying to remember his name, Carrie Ryu. For the Wall Street Journal. He was the guy back in 2015. In fact, it was... He's really responsible for blowing the lid on this one. And we've seen, I haven't seen any interviews with him. I've been looking around for them on Theranos back in 2015 for the Wall Street Journal. But the question is about Rupert Murdoch, because he was one of the big investors, and yet it was him that blew the lid on the scam. What do you make of that?
Yeah, that is a big mystery to me. You know, that I don't know how to explain that. Rupert Murdoch was the biggest investor of all in Theranos. He invested $125 million in Theranos. So he was involved. But when John Carreyrou wanted to publish his story, Elizabeth Holmes on two occasions personally went to Rupert Murdoch to beg him to kill the story, to not publish it. And Rupert Murdoch, who is known to not hesitate to intervene in the editorial policy of Wall Street Journal and his other publications, so he's not above that. But he said, "I trust my journalists and editors that they will do the right thing. I will let them publish the story if they think it's a good story to publish." And I have no idea how to explain that, Tony. I know that, you know, like from various things I've read in the past, I know that Rupert Murdoch had been financed by the Rothschilds. Okay. And I wonder if this isn't like a very high level civil war between, you know, these banking families, where, you know, like maybe the Rothschilds decided to kill a project that was controlled by the Rockefellers. I don't know. I'm completely speculating.
Well, okay, so let me put my two halfpence in here, because I've noticed that the Murdoch empire isn't quite as nasty as it used to be. It seems to have sort of toned down a little bit, particularly with Fox News in the United States blowing the lid on the links between, I mean, these are massive networks watched by tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of people. And so they play a very important role. And that, for them to blow the lid on through Steve Hilton and Tucker Carlson on the Pentagon funding and the Peter Daszak EcoHealth Alliance funding of gain of function research in Wuhan, at the Wuhan Virology Institute, was, I think, an amazing piece of journalism, because it made it impossible for the deep state to pin the COVID, whole COVID business and the virus on the Chinese. We've also got in Australia, Sky News Australia, doing quite a good job.
Yeah, I know.
And in one of the most horrific parts of the world, where the lockdowns are being almost now a religion to the government and oppressing the people, incredible. We've got Novak Djokovic sitting in the customs hall, apparently, this week, waiting to be let into, even though he's got his medical exemption, the Australian government not wanting to let him in. And I think he has, you know, done an amazing job, really, and in principles. But also here in Britain, we've got Talk Radio, which is only on the DAB Plus digital system, but it's on YouTube, etc. as well. And they seem to be really at the cutting edge of getting on top of the pandemic. So the Murdoch empire seems to be, you know, maybe it's not all about money for Rupert anymore. He's getting on a bit.
I have, Tony, I have noticed everything you say. And my conclusions are very similar. And I must say, I'm really intrigued. I don't know how to explain this. But I've noticed that the Murdoch empire has been playing a role that seems positive to me in all this. And, you know, I hesitate to go as far as calling Rupert Murdoch and his creditors, the Rothschilds, as the good guys. But, you know, on the other hand, I can't completely dismiss it out of hands either. You know, like there are things going on at those levels of power that, you know, that are not being disclosed, that there's no paper trail. There's no, you know, like all of those discussions. Even, you know, like one thing I might mention about Elizabeth Holmes' relationship with Don Lucas Sr., her venture capital partner, is that there was nothing written between them. You know, like he did not have an email account at all. He did not receive emails. Any documents that were being discussed had to be brought in hard copy, and then they would be destroyed, and nothing was discussed over the phone either. So, you know, like at those levels of power, they will be sure not to create any kind of a paper trail and any kind of a evidence that would hold up in court. So we have to kind of watch the situation and try to interpret it as best we can. Inevitably, these are conspiracies, and we're going to have to be theorizing about them. But I think it's very interesting, the role of Murdoch Empire, both in the Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos case and in this whole pandemic situation. And, you know, like with all the various things that you hear reported on Fox News in the United States, it's really fascinating.
Well, it's also, of course, the fact that the main villain in one of the Bond films, it's called Tomorrow Never Dies. His name's Elliot Carver. He's almost modelled on Rupert Murdoch. I wonder if Murdoch hasn't watched the film, got a little bit uncomfortable and thought, well, I don't want to end up like this guy. Anyway, look, if you could just round up, Alex, by just reminding us where people can find you online.
All right. So I have a personal blog called The Naked Hedgie, right? So it's thenakedhedgie.com simply. I have for people.
Can you just spell that for us?
The Naked Hedgie, naked as in like the Naked Chef, like, you know, what's the guy's name? Neil, Jamie Oliver, right? Naked Hedgie, Hedgie, right? As like a hedge fund manager, Hedgie, right?
Hedgie.com, is that?
.com, that's right. And then for people who trade their money, manage portfolios and so forth, I have a professional website called iSystem Trend Following, where I provide turnkey portfolio solutions and daily decision support reports. And then on Twitter, I'm Naked Hedgie, at Naked Hedgie. Again, the same spelling. Sorry, YouTube channel, Markets, Trends and Profits. Markets, Trends and Profits channel.
Okay, well, I'll link to those on our show page. Thanks very much for joining us again, Alex Craner from Monaco, is it?
That's right. I'm based in Monaco. I'm by nationality. I'm originally Croatian.
Okay, Alex, thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure.